Welcome to Family Matters, the Adoption UK podcast. My name is Sarah, your host for this episode, and we are going to be talking about parenting from a distance. And I have two guests with me today, have Penny and Philippa, and I'm just going to ask them to introduce themselves. So, Philippa.
Hi there, I'm Philippa. I'm the Learning and Development Manager at Adoption UK in Wales, and my work involves supporting families and parents individually and in groups, and sorting out the training programme that we offer here in Wales at the moment. I'm also an adoptive parent. Our children are now adults, one's 30 and one's 25. Our son left home prematurely. Our daughter left home in a very planned way, and they both had very different journeys, but we're parenting both of them from a distance now because neither live at home.
Okay, thank you. So you are both working in this professionally, and you've got a lot of personal experience as well that you bring to this.
That's right, yeah.
Thank you. And Penny?
Hi, I'm Penny. I work with Philippa in Wales. I do a lot of, we do training, we do support groups, as Philippa says. I also work across the UK, End of the Path team, supporting families. I am an adoptive parent. My son is now 17, and I have sporadically parented him from a distance from about the age of 12, and I also run the Parenting from a Distance community group that Adoption UK runs.
Okay, thank you, Penny. So can I start by just asking you both, what is parenting from a distance? Can I start, maybe Philippa, can I start with you?
I think there are many different ways of parenting from a distance. For us, it's being able to maintain a relationship with our son, although we can't live at home because our relationship at home became untenable and quite risky in terms of his behaviour towards my husband and I. He was quite physically violent towards one or both of us throughout his childhood and his adolescence. And we desperately wanted to continue our relationship with him. So we now parent, since he was 17, we've had to parent him when he wasn't living at home with us.
Okay, so you maintain your relationship with him?
Absolutely, through absolute thick and thin, through the most horrific challenges. When we were told, you shouldn't see him, you can't see him, we found ways to keep in touch with him throughout the last 13 years.
Okay, and that relationship has endured?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Penny, Penny, is that your experience as well?
Yes, yeah. I mean, my son moved out for very similar reasons, in that the police said it just wasn't safe for us to live together because he was extremely violent because of his early life trauma. You know, he'd had a really, really tricky, devastating start to his life, and that played out his behaviour and his inability to regulate his emotional responses. And it did become really unsafe. So he was then, he moved out into residential care. And my son has been here, there and everywhere with his residential care. So I'm in Cardiff. The furthest away he went to was Glasgow.
Wow.
So and during all of that time, he's now living in a hostel very close to me. But during all those years of him being moved around to different places, we have maintained our relationship. And it's really, really important to both of us that relationship has been maintained. So, for example, when he was in Glasgow, I was flying up there every fortnight to see him. Sometimes he wouldn't want to see me, but even so, I'd turn up and I'd say, hi, I'm here, it's fine, just let me know if you want to see me this weekend. So it's just that constant thing, I'm here, I want to be in your life, I love you, I want to play a role with you, you're important to me. So but obviously there's loads of other reasons why people parent from a distance. It could be that their children get involved in things like county lines or really difficult criminal behaviour. It could be that the sibling issues are going on and it's not safe for them to stay in the home. They could reconnect with birth family and move that way. There's all sorts of different reasons why people parent from a distance. And it's much more common than you might think. But from my experience, what is key throughout it all is the parents and the children's desire to have a relationship, no matter what, particularly on the parents' side.
Okay. So you've talked about some of the reasons why a child might leave the home prematurely. So relational trauma then, and that makes it difficult, how would you say, Philippa, in terms of a child being parented in the home?
For us, our son, we felt that he was unable to accept having two parents who loved and cared about him
right.
deeply. And it, as he got older into his teenage years, and he started trying to develop relationships, romantic relationships, he couldn't manage those either. And as a result, his violence towards us became worse because he was really recognising how his trauma was affecting any deep relationship he was trying to have with anybody. And at that stage, at 14, 15, 16, he couldn't cognitively explain that to us. No. Whereas now as a 30-year-old, he has developed amazing ability to reflect. And we pat ourselves on the back and think if we hadn't stuck by him, he would never have developed that ability to reflect. He still struggles with relationships, don't get me wrong. He's not leading, he's not sort of a lawyer earning lots of money. He still needs a great deal of support from us, but he absolutely can reflect now on why it was such a struggle for him. And he's no longer physically violent to us at all.
Okay. So this is a long road.
Mm.
This is what you're saying, isn't it? Parenting from a distance is not a sort of short-term thing. It is long-lasting. And as you said, it's kind of no matter what, through thick and thin. So you've both talked about dysregulated responses, you know, and all of this is rooted in trauma, isn't it? Or much of it. But that can make life, despite the reasons for it, it can make family life dangerous, and particularly, you know, like depending on your parenting on your own. And if you've got other children in the home as well, so that, you know, you hear that quite commonly, don't you, that that is a reason. It's just keeping everybody safe. And you've mentioned exploitation and grooming, which, you know, Adoption UK, we unfortunately hear about that commonly, I would say. Would you, Philippa, is it something you come across?
Absolutely. I mean, when my son has lived in 50 different places since he left home, and one of the places he lived, he was at risk of exploitation. I think the word's cuckooing.
Yes.
And because I was parented from a distance, I was turning up all times of the day at night at his flat. And he now says to me, Mum, he said, they did try to come in my flat with their equipment and their knives and whatnot, but they said, who's that woman in the silver car who keeps turning up? It was just a no-go because I would, and I didn't realise at the time that he was at that level of risk. I just was doing what I thought I should do as a parent. So I'd take food, I'd go and pick his laundry up, I'd drive past if I was going through the area. And I'm really relieved that I did it now. But at the time, I didn't realise.
Yeah. And we do hear about children being exploited, even when they're living at home. And the difficulties of protecting children from, you know, the power that, you know, criminals can have over children, particularly children with relational trauma. So for anyone listening who is going through that initial, you know, the child leaving the home or they're in the aftermath of that, how difficult is that for parents going through that?
I think it's really hard, isn't it? From what I can, because you feel like, I think when it happens, you feel lots of things. You might feel guilt, you might feel
judged,
you might feel like you're a failure. You might also feel a sense of relief because you might feel safe for the first time in a very long time. You might, you know, you're getting judgment from professionals, and if you do get to the stage where you are parenting from a distance, you probably might have thought to get some support and help for a long time.
Right.
And it's frustrating because often that help and support doesn't come in, and then you end up parenting from a distance, and that's really sad. So you have a real mixture of emotions. You feel an enormous sense of loss,
right?
Because your child's not there. You're not being a direct parent. You're not getting up in the morning, giving them their breakfast, doing all those things, and you worry about whether they are being looked after properly, what sort of care they're getting. when my son, very quite similar to Philippa in a way, my son, I felt, couldn't cope with the intensity of our relationship. He couldn't cope with being having a mother that loved him no matter what. And ironically, when he went back into the care system, he really settled into that pretty well. He felt comfortable with the transactional relationship. So you're a carer, you're paid to look after me, you go off shift at midnight, somebody else appears. He seemed to be able to be okay with that. So that really helped my feelings of guilt about what I was doing. But also, you just feel very alone and you feel like, am I still an adoptive parent? Am I still a parent? And that's what I think, when it happened to me, I felt very alone, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to start the group, because I wanted people to know that they weren't alone and they were still a parent. And they were still part of the adoption world.
So coming to terms with that is hard.
Yeah.
And readjusting, I guess, to... I mean, it's very different, isn't it? The systems are different. For a start, the bureaucracy around it, you're all of a sudden having to think about things like housing, maybe, benefits.
What's contact going to look like? What does that mean? Because often you're told in the beginning, well, they're not going to see you for a while because they need to get settled into their new environment. And that's just like heartbreaking. And then you do, I mean, I've had a few really heartbreaking times with my son where I've met him somewhere neutral, shall we say, for contact. And then we've both just sobbed at the end of it because it's a loss over and over again. So those sort of things are really, really tricky to cope with.
I remember being told, you've got to step back and let him reach rock bottom.
Right.
And what is rock bottom? Our children who've experienced early life trauma, they experience rock bottom then. And I don't think walking away from them until they're homeless or even worse is the answer.
Right.
So I did step away about 2 weeks, and the services who said they'd step up sadly were unable to, didn't. So that was the last time I ever took advice about stepping away and letting them reach rock bottom.
Right. And have you had times where you had to temporarily step away, or have you been there, you know, for every call, every need?
No, I've definitely learned over the years. Actually, I'm stopping my son from standing on his own 2 feet by stepping in.
Okay.
So I didn't discover something called non-violent resistance until my son was 15, but now I use something called the basket approach. And before I talk to him about something or step in, I'll think, is this absolutely essential to do today or not? And if it's not, I don't do it. And I no longer feel guilty. I feel I've made a choice here.
Okay. So you're picking off the more major, more important things.
Yeah.
And you kind of just, what you're doing with the rest of it, just pushing it to one side.
I push it to one side. Sometimes I'll say, well, I'll think about this again tomorrow. If it still rears its ugly face, then maybe I might have to do something about it. But an awful lot of the time now, it doesn't rear its face again. Okay. And I've learned that that's about me and how I react. Rather than what's going on for my son.
Okay, so some things go away.
Absolutely.
Right, so learning that you don't have to fix everything.
Yeah, yeah. I think things like health issues, where my son will phone and say he thinks he's got some life-threatening disease. That's his anxiety showing. He hasn't got a life-threatening disease. And working out, does he need to go to A&E or does he just need me to... We've delivered first aid stuff to him and 2 weeks later he'll give it back and say, I don't need it, because he didn't have anything like threatening. He just wanted to see his mum or his dad.
Right. Want some contact.
Right. We talk as well about, you know, the different services that you may have to work with when your child leaves the home can be quite different from what you've got experience of. How hard would you say it is to get used to all those different systems and different people? And is there anything you can do to sort of help yourself, really?
I think the big change for me was suddenly your child is back in the care system and they don't necessarily listen to you as the parent, even if you have got them on a temporary, a voluntary admission, and that you still have full parental responsibility. They're not necessarily used to parents getting involved to this extent. My son is now sits in something called the 14 plus team, and I remember they were organising an education meeting, and they said, "Oh," and I said, "Oh, I'll look forward to receiving my invite." And they said, "Oh no, we don't have parents at those meetings." And I thought, "Well, absolutely, you are going to have me there at that meeting because he's my child." So I think it's you have to fight to get your voice heard as a parent a bit, little bit more
okay.
than you would have done when they were living with you. Because obviously, as a parent, when they're living with you, you are top dog, as it were, in terms of a hierarchy. So you have to fight a little bit more. And people make decisions about your child that you might not like, which is quite hard. You still have to be there to negotiate, to advocate, to do all that stuff, but you're possibly doing it from a bit of a different position, and it might be might feel a bit more like you're pushing against a closed door.
So you are you become a little bit
so an anomaly,
yeah.
is what you're describing.
Yeah. I went through what Penny was going through, and feeling that I didn't matter.
Oh.
We're sort of 13 years further down the line than Penny is now. And those professionals who made me feel quite overlooked, as if I was a bad parent, I now come across them partly through work, but also because my son still touches on services sometimes. And now they say things like, "I can't believe you stepped by him. I didn't realise at the time what it was like for you. I can see now you're part of the solution, not part of the problem. Can you tell me about how to behave when I go to talk to your son about letting the gas services into services boiler?" And I think in being able to be resilient through all those years and keep on advocating him for him was essential.
Yeah.
Because I am his mum. Yes, he's had advocates who some of them have been superb, some of them not so good. But they're paid and they go home at the end of the day. I'm his mum. And the way we can advocate for our children and how essential it is to maintain our resilience through those times when you don't know where your position is and you're not invited to the education meeting. That's
It's very hard. And they do, you know, we do feel part of the beginning because they can't, a lot of the time they're inexperienced in, or they don't understand why our children behave as they do and how incredibly difficult it is to manage that behaviour in a normal family home. And I think that when it does first happen, you feel like you have to sort of advocate for yourself a bit and say, look, what my son did, which is what your son did, is that he played out those behaviours in every environment that he was in. So everybody did finally understand, oh my gosh, this child is really complex and this he needs something very specific to support him, where whatever context he's in. And then they were like, wow, like Philippa says, you know, this is really tough.
Right. So the system needed to see it for themselves rather than trust what you were, how you were describing your family life.
Yeah.
How much do you think there is a need to increase the knowledge amongst professionals working in the care system about relational trauma and how it plays out in real life?
Huge. Sorry, it came up in the parenting resistance group. It's a theme that comes up in that group about how they really want social workers particularly to have some more understanding as to why our children behave as they do and what they need to help them to feel safe and secure. Because it's people seem to be continually being exposed to professionals who don't get it,
right,
and who come at it from a very behavioural perspective. And you absolutely can't do that with our children.
I think in the adoption support teams, we come across professionals who absolutely get
it.
Yeah.
However, the way funding works in Wales, and I'm assuming it's quite similar in England, the money for the therapy and the support doesn't come through the adoption support team directly. They have to go with their begging bowls to other social work teams. And it's those other teams.
It's the intake and assessment teams, the child protection teams.
Yeah, the lack of understanding and the huge caseloads they've got. I don't think anyone goes into social work thinking I'm going to earn a lot of money out of this and be able to go home at 5 o'clock and have a wonderful life.
Yeah.
but they get ground down by the system and their caseloads. So I don't know what the answer is, but we have come across some incredible social workers. Yeah.
And I do think they are caring people operating in a very difficult environment. That's the issue, I think. But it should be a core part of what they are learning. It's about trauma and how it portrays. Because I always say to people, unless you've walked in our shoes, you can't really get it. And I used to say, when I was at my lowest points and I was asking for respite, I used to say to social workers, do you want him to come and stay at your house for a night and see how you get on? Because I felt like it was the only way they were going to really understand what it was like. Mm. Obviously, they didn't accept that offer of mine, my generous offer, but they didn't seem to get what I was talking about or how a 9-year-old child could be so extreme in his behaviours. You know, I'd been to hospital 3 times in a month, you know, because he'd chuck stuff at me and things like that. And they couldn't grasp that was a real threat. And it wasn't his, you know, he wasn't doing it because he wanted to hurt me. He was doing it because of his, you know, he couldn't regulate himself enough.
So there is a challenge in bringing to life in a vivid way for people around families what it is like in real terms. And like you say, you know, your son left the home and then ended up living in various different places where that trauma was visible, and then all of a sudden everybody gets how hard it's been for you. But what you need is that further up the track, don't you? You need that understanding vividly of what it is like for families trying to manage that. I want to move on a bit now and just talk about some of the strategies that you can use to support children who are living away from home and to keep in touch with them in a way that, you know, in a way that they can cope with and that they can accept. And the first thing I just want to move on to is just basic keeping in touch. Mm. So when you've both described parenting a child who couldn't cope with the intensity of a very, very close parental relationship, how do you both keep in touch now so that you don't touch on that intensity, Philippa?
We've experimented with all sorts of ways of keeping in touch. So when our son first left home, he would come back to our home, and it didn't end well. He was still angry, couldn't understand where his feelings, so we had broken doors and smashed windows. So that little experiment we put on the back burner for a bit. Even talking to him on the phone sometimes was too much for him. Okay. So over the years, sometimes it's been text, sometimes it's been other social media platforms, and I do find that being able to write it down helps pause things a little. So I tend to, if I need to say something, I'll write it down. He'll say to my husband, what do you think if I was to put it like this? And he'll say, well, that's a bit wordy. so then I'll reword it, and then I'll leave it to the next day. And sometimes then it doesn't even need to be sent. My husband, on the other hand, he sees my son and they go to the cinema, they go out for breakfast, they've started going for walks again. So I think that keeping in touch depends on me as an individual and other people around him. And when things were at their worst, I reached out to a lot of friends and family and said, could you keep in touch?
Okay.
So we've got one friend who, he's only met her once or twice. And that was 13 years ago. I asked her to start reaching out. Every Christmas, every birthday, she sends him a Moonpig card. Other card companies are available. And a bar of a well-known chocolate that he doesn't even like, that particular chocolate. But he always says to me, "Mum, this woman's amazing. She's still sending me chocolate and cards." And he doesn't really need that level of contact now. But it wasn't close family members, because at that time they didn't get my son. They just felt, my poor daughter, my poor sister, she's going through this, my sister-in-law. So I didn't reach out to them. I reached out to people, friends, colleagues. And I know Penny, if I was to say to Penny over the years, do you think you could pop over and pick some laundry up, send a message, she would. And even though it doesn't really need doing. We have been to his flat a few times. Me knowing I've got somebody I can ask.
Okay.
So it's not just about my son having somebody that's reaching out to him. Me knowing I've got people I can reach out to is huge.
Sharing that load.
Yeah.
So you're describing something that's quite low intensity type of contact. You know, it's light touch. It's, you know, it's a message that you think about. You think about how it's going to land. Mm. And it's people who are not deeply knitted into the family.
You think about MDR as well. It's about, it's using those reconciliation gestures, so those unconditional acts of love, really.
Right.
Those, like you say, low intensity, low impact, but actually just letting them know that you see them, you know they're there, we care about you, in whatever way. Because it absolutely isn't fixed either, is it? It has to evolve over time, depending on what they can and can't cope with.
Okay.
So with my son, I used to, there have been times where I have just sent him things, sent him a little letter, sent him something through the post, like Philippa, when he's, because he was in care when COVID was on. So I would, when they were in lockdown because somebody in the home had got COVID, I used to get my friends and family to send him something. Could be a, you know, a magazine, a film, a cake card when my friends sent him. So that's that thing that we're holding. What I try and do always, and I think that's what you try and do, Philippa, is let them know that we're holding them in our hearts and minds.
They're not invisible.
They're not invisible. We're here. Okay. We see you. We're keeping in touch with you, however it is.
And those tokens, you described giving tokens of that.
Yeah.
Love and affection and enduring relationship. And they're not big things, are they?
No, it's expectation little... that there's anything going to come back in return.
Right.
They're very unconditional. When my son, I have had proper contact with my son when he's been in now. We're in a situation now where he can come and see me, and we see each other quite a lot, and it's going really well. But it's on my terms now, and it's very, you know, okay. Like he copes with that really well. He likes really firm boundaries around what is and isn't okay. But when he was in residential settings, I used to let him take the lead as to what he wanted to do with me. So it could be simply like sitting in his room for half an hour. It could be going out. I've played golf, tennis, you name it. I've done it, trampolining. Whatever he wanted to do, I would do it. It could be going out for a meal. Often we had support staff with us because they often said that we couldn't be on our own together because of the risk. That felt really awkward at times, but also we've met some really lovely people through that, and people have been really supportive of doing it. It evolves very much, but it's always in my head is the letting them know that we're keeping them in heart and mind, we're thinking of them, and I think that's one of the reasons why I have got the relationship I've got with my son now, because I've, even when he didn't want to speak to me, I used to still just reach out very gently, phone the home and say, can you just, you know, say that I've phoned, so that he knows that even if he's not speaking to me, I'm thinking of him, you know.
So you've held him, you've held him in your mind
all the time, yeah.
And we hear, don't we, sometimes the term the golden thread, that,
yes,
you know, it's not a great big heavy rope that ties you together, but it is that, you know, it's that connection where you're demonstrating that, you know, they are part of you and you are part of them.
Mm. I remember the first time we went on holiday without our son, and I felt terribly guilty going, but we went. And he phoned me and we were abroad and he said, oh, Mum, and he was living in a hostel at the time, Mum, I need a towel. I said, well, I'm thousands of miles away. I can't bring you a towel. And he was getting himself so upset and worked up. So I phoned one of my amazing supporters who happens to be an adopted dad. I said, not any chance you could drop a towel down to the hostel. And he jumped in the car, took a towel down. By the time he got there, our son had gone past needing a towel. But when he came back to the hostel, the towel was there, and he knew that I was holding him, even though I was thousands of miles away, and that other people, our friend, felt our son was that important, that, yeah, I will drop a towel down.
Somebody in the post, in the group said last time we met, he said, his dad said, I'm getting used to the new normal. That's how he described it.
Right.
And that everybody sort of, people like that term of actually, this is, you are still a parent, you are still, they are still your child. This is a new normal, but we're operating in a different way.
So although it feels like you described what it's like in the early days and months, you know, it's extremely difficult for everybody involved, but you adjust to it. and you learn how to do it, and you learn about each other and what works. And you've described having to be very patient as well.
But also, you have to acknowledge the loss. I mean, there wasn't a time when I didn't visit my son for quite a long time where I didn't drive home or fly home when he was in Glasgow in tears. That sense of loss is just overwhelming. But where I'm at now with it is that I'm just really so glad that we've got a relationship and that I'm seeing him, and we can have a relationship without him. He's like Philippa's son. He started to be reflective. He started to identify what's going on. He knows when he's getting dysregulated, and he knows what to do about it. But we've had to go through all this stuff to get to where we are. And I think it's okay. I feel okay. I feel really proud of our relationship, actually, if I'm honest, because we've been through such a lot. And I think I am really proud that we've got the relationship we've got.
That's lovely. I think we should draw that to a close, this to a close on that note. That's brilliant. And, you know, it's lovely to hear you say that it's not the end of the world, even though it felt like it at the time. It wasn't the end of the world, and it is a new normal, and you do get used to it. And what you've got at the end of it is what you describe as a really positive and close relationship. So thank you, both of you, very much, Penny and Philippa. And if anyone listening would like to join or know more about Penny's Parenting from a Distance group, Penny, what should they do? Ring this information support line?
Yes, support line. They've got all the details and they'll pass them on to me, yeah.
Okay, so what we'll do is post the phone number, contact details of that phone line into the show notes. It's also on the Adoption UK webpage. It's very visible on the homepage. So if you ring that line and you ask about Penny's group, so it's called Parenting from a Distance Community Group, they can tell you more about it. Thank you for listening. Please follow us on all major podcast platforms and look out for future episodes. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.